From the Emory Wheel, I'm Gabriella Lewis. This is Wheel Talk. Finals, 80-degree weather, and a surge in last-minute lunch plans to catch up with distant friends, signifying one thing. It's the end of the semester. While COVID talk feels like the constant elephant in the room, today, in the final Wheel Talk of the school year, we're taking a break from the pandemic and focusing on some of the lighter topics that we haven't had a chance to cover on the podcast. So, this week's episode will be a little different. I'll be joined by assistant producers to discuss three stories: Emory's controversial SGA election, politics and diversity within the culinary world, and two new exhibits at the High Museum of Art. First, we'll hear from Wheel reporter Jareer Imran to discuss the allegations of wrongdoing and Constitutional Council's hearing and verdict in the student government elections. After, assistant producers Catherine Anaizwe and Carly Colin will discuss with opinion editor Sophia Ling her brand new column. And last, assistant producer and senior critic Ethan Anthony will break down the latest and greatest at the High Museum with arts and entertainment writer Robert Furman. Hi, Jareer. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. So can you tell us who you are and what you've been doing these past couple of weeks at The Wheel?
Sure. So I'm a reporter for The Wheel. I typically cover college council meetings. This past month, I've been covering this big SGA debacle.
So this SGA story has been huge. It's been one of the biggest stories of my time at Emory, definitely of the past year and definitely of the past semester. So we're going to break that down right now. The SGA election and the college council election, all these other student government elections, you know, start at the regular time, etc. Earlier in the year, we have the Wheel debates, and there's an SGA election going on with three vice presidential candidates and three presidential candidates. And so then after this first election, it goes down to a runoff, which is between running mates Rachel Ding for president and Amon Pearson for vice president, and then Rio Kumar for president and Nick Pichetto for vice president. Again, these are two running mates. The runoff is underway, and on March 24th, Sunwoo Park, who's a fourth-year legislator in college council, makes a post on his Instagram and files a petition stating that there's been election wrongdoing. And it's pretty unexpected when this comes out. Can you explain to us what's in that petition and what follows from that petition?
So the petition, it's 7 pages. Sunwoo, he's basically pulling from the Code of Elections and he's pointing out these supposed violations. Current SGA president, Lori Steffel, and current BBA president that's in the business school, Emily Ferguson, he's saying they're elections board officers. And he's saying that they endorsed candidates Rhea Kumar and Nick Pichetto. If you're on the Board of Elections and you're also endorsing people, that puts the integrity of elections into question. Another allegation he had was Katie Lee, who was just elected vice president of the BBA Council, that she campaigned for Rhea and Nick while also running for office herself. And Emory specifically has a no party clause in order to kind of prevent political party formation from happening.
And this petition kind of blows up. It's mostly solicited around Instagram, and it gets a ton of attention from the student body. You know, this is a pretty big story for a lot of different people. There's emotion on all sides. Can you explain to us what steps are taken after this petition is filed?
We reach out to the Board of Elections, and they tell us that the Constitutional Council, who is this big kind of the Supreme Court of Emory, they say, we're going to freeze the elections. Nobody finds out who won. Nobody finds out what's going on because we don't know what's going on. So the elections freeze. The Constitutional Council reaches out to Sunwoo and they're like, look, officially you have to resubmit a petition in 48 hours according to our Constitution, our Code of Elections. And 2 days later, he files a revised petition. The original one was 7 pages and it had about like 10, 15 pieces of evidence. This new petition is 28 pages with nearly 90 pieces of evidence. And it's a wide array of allegations and ideas of corruption and misdoing and that, you know, bring the kind of integrity of the election into question. And, you know, as this is happening, just the story just gets crazier and crazier. It just keeps unfolding. Members of the elections board, including the chair of the Board of Elections, resigns. So the pretrial proceedings start. The defendants file a 30-page rebuttal to Sunwoo's initial petition. Sunwoo files another 50 pages in rebuttal to that. As the pretrial proceedings are happening, someone files an injunction with Constitutional Council, and they agree to release the results, the unofficial, uncertified results. And it has Rachel Ding winning the presidency, but it has her running mate, Amon Pearson, losing to Riya Kumar's running mate, Nick Pichetto. So you have a split ticket win, in theory. And it's interesting because it was probably the closest election, you know, seen in a long time. It was Rachel Ding won by 22 votes, Nick Pichetto won by 56 votes. And this kind of brings into question, if Nick Pichetto was winning by 56 votes, and if all these allegations are coming out of like integrity, if it's so close, then, you know, this is something important. This is something to think about.
Okay, so basically, just to reiterate, so I have it right, on March 24th, this original petition is filed. Everything starts from Sun Wu. And then on 25th, the election results are frozen. And then on March 28th, the official petition is filed. And then people start to resign. Emily Ferguson and Lori Steffel come back saying, releasing statements saying that they didn't do anything wrong. And then on March 30th, they do release the results, although uncertified, saying that Rachel Ding and Nick Pichetto won. Correct.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, Sun Wu says they're members of the Board of Elections. And like you mentioned, they come out and they say, no, we're not. And so we're coming up on this trial, and there's a lot of, well, yes, and well, no. The kind of focus going into the trial is, you know, are they members of the Board of Elections or not? And this is kind of something where the Constitutional Council interprets the Constitution, interprets the code, and kind of makes a decision.
And so you've hinted at, Dreer, is this trial, which all eyes are on the trial. It's on April 8th, and there's just such a hubbub around campus. I mean, at one point, there was 660 devices watching the trial, and that's just devices, right? There's people huddling around, there's watch parties. It feels like the whole school, or at least a large portion of the school, has all eyes on this trial. It ends up lasting nearly 4 hours. Can you explain to us what this trial looked like? Again, it's all over Zoom, but, you know, there's a communal feeling because we're all there and we're all watching it.
It's definitely on everyone's mind. It's the talk of the town. It's people, you know, the whole day leading up to it, people are like, what time is the trial? Where are we watching this? You know, like you said, the lobbies are filled with people watching on the TV, the, you know, lounges, rooms, like it's everywhere. This is a huge deal. It starts with opening cases. It starts with Sun Wu opening the trial. He gives kind of a summary of why he's here, what the allegations are. And then the defense, which is Lori Steffel, Emily Ferguson, Katie Lee, Riya Kumar, Nick Pichetto campaign as well. They're going on and they're like, look, this is why what you're saying is wrong. And then Sun Wu does another rebuttal to their opening. And then they go into witnesses, you know. And these witnesses are, you know, from all walks of life. We have former elections board members. We have people who've, like, constitutional experts who've, like, even graduated from Emory. We have character witnesses. It's a whole swath. It's a whole array of people. And the trial kind of starts with this idea of, is Lori Steffel and is Emily Ferguson a member of the Board of Elections? And the trial kind of evolves into the allegations of misdoing by Katie Lee and the Kumar Pichetto campaign. And the question becomes, did Riya and Nick violate the privacy of hundreds or even thousands of students on Emory's campus? You know, there were people were complaining that their phone numbers had been taken and that the campaign was trying to solicit their votes, that they were getting spammed with these messages. And people are like, where are these phone numbers coming from? And, you know, are bots being used? Because investigated this as part of the story, we'd call these phone numbers back and we'd get no response. And the Kumar Pichetto campaign is like, we didn't use bots, we used textfree.us. And a little bit of digging into textfree.us, it's an unverified method of campaigning that was never given permission and that still violated student privacy. Another part that this kind of trial transitions into is Katie Lee, who is president of AKSI. It's a business fraternity at Emory. And what kind of comes out is that Katie Lee is asking pledges, you know, who've been working for, you know, hard for like the past couple of weeks to try and get into AKSI. First, she constantly berated them, was like, I'm endorsing Riya and Nick. I really think you should vote for Riya and Nick. And then she's like, okay, folks, now you have to vote and you have to show me proof that you voted. And the question kind of becomes, is this voter intimidation? Is this allowed? And Katie Lee's defense is, I'm trying to increase turnout.
And, you know, the big thing here that I think everyone going into the trial is realizing is that there's been a complete shift in what is talking about. And especially by the end of this, like you've kind of mentioned, you know, we go into this thinking that it's a, are Ferguson and Steffel on the elections board? That's kind of the main center point. And then it turns into this student privacy issue and this voter intimidation issue. And it really, you know, the tone shifts entirely. And coming out of the trial, there's, you know, these dramatic back and forths and dramatic questioning. And then it ends with this verdict on the 13th from the Constitutional Council. What does the verdict rule?
Defendants guilty of all charges. They recommend Katie Lee for impeachment from Vice President of BPA. They say that Lori Steffel and Emily Ferguson are guilty of being elections board members. They clarify that because they were present in the actions of the Board of Elections, even if they did nothing, that they were still elections board members. Because Emily had resigned and Lori had been removed from the board, that the action had been rectified. They ordered the original elections were nullified. They said, we have to do another set of elections, but Rhea Kumar and Nick Pichetto are banned from running in the next set of elections.
So that's kind of where it comes to the end. And, you know, it's 29 days of really great uncertainty. And then, like you said, they do the election for a third time over. and so there's now a runoff. And the only people on the ballot are Rachel Ding and Amon Pearson. There's a pretty low turnout for this one. But ultimately, because they're running against no one else, they win. And on April 22nd, they're announced as the SGA president and vice president elect. And that's where it ends. But it's been a month of craziness.
I mean, Rachel, Amon, they have their work cut out for them. You know, a lot of people have to sit down and ask, where did we go wrong? How did we let this happen? How can we prevent this from ever happening again?
Although the elections debacle still leaves many in disbelief, now let's turn to the story of opinion editor Sophia Ling and her brand new column, Sophia's Smorgasbord.
Hi, my name is Carly, and I'm a producer on this podcast.
I'm Catherine. I'm also a producer on this podcast.
Can you tell us a bit about your column, Sophia's Smorgasbord? What topics have you covered so far? What was the inspiration for this topic? I know it started just a couple months ago.
I've always been interested in cooking and eating, and I really like talking about food. I've talked about coffee, Bon Appetit, which is a food magazine, like other famous chefs as well.
So, like you said, you've written a lot about a variety of food-related topics, from coffee culture to racism in the food industry. What made you want to start a discussion that looks at food in a more social context?
Food is just, like, inherently it's a social thing, right? It brings people together. It covers such a broad context in terms of how it's seen around the world. There are, like, different cuisines. There are different ways to cook different types of food. And every chef brings their own experience. They bring their own stories to the types of food that they're cooking. And when it gets served onto a table, the people at the table also have their own stories to tell while they're enjoying this food. And I think food is something that everybody enjoys, even though we might have different preferences. You know, it's something that brings people together, really unites people. But at the same time, it can also be a really divisive, you know, political weapon, depending on the way it's being, like, treated or not treated well in terms of racism and, you know, social inequalities.
In some of your articles, you discuss food in a really fun and lighthearted way. For example, earlier this month, you wrote an article called "You've Been Hoodwinked, Bamboozled, and Led Astray. Rectangle sandwiches are better." Can you tell us a little about this piece and your experience writing it?
The debate revolving triangle sandwiches and rectangle sandwiches is just something that I see on social media. Maybe I'm looking at the wrong part of social media. And then I just thought that perhaps the reason that we all think that triangle sandwiches are better is because we're conditioned to think that triangle sandwiches are better, and in reality, rectangle sandwiches are actually superior, in which case I feel like I proved that in my article, even though somebody commented afterwards and said that my theory was incorrect.
You also tackle serious dimensions of food and the impact it can have on how we view society. Your article about Tunde Wei and the politicization of food, as well as your piece on racism within the food magazine Bon Appetit, ask very thought-provoking questions about the role food should play in our fights for greater social equity. What can food and the culture around food tell us about social justice?
In terms of, like, the Bon Appetit article, where staff of color were not being paid for their appearances on their YouTube videos, it's important to see that in the industry as a whole, a lot of people of color actually, like, they're talented cooks and they have a lot to bring to the food industry, especially in the United States, I think. But a lot of times their cuisine is also like not being respected because like racial inequality, and that, you know, white chefs can adopt a sort of cuisine and bring it back. And you see that all the people who are like, you're an expert in what cuisine, like most of those names are attached to white chefs. In terms of the way that food has been appropriated, I think in America, being Chinese, like I know that a lot of people will tell me that their favorite Chinese dish is like orange chicken or pineapple chicken, which frankly I find a little bit insulting because neither of those things are Chinese. And I think it just like it brings a greater discussion of how we should treat cuisine that's not necessarily something that we're familiar with, and like we don't necessarily have the whole story. But at the same time, I think it's hard to constantly be thinking of those things when you're cooking, when you're eating those foods.
And for our final story, we shift from the socialization of food to the social experience of visiting the High Museum.
Hi, I'm senior critic and assistant podcast producer Ethan Anthony. I'm here with Robert from the Arts and Entertainment section.
I'm Robert Furman. I'm a staff writer for the Emory Wheel.
You've been to Atlanta's renowned High Museum of Art a couple of times this semester. First to see the visitors, and then to see underexposed women photographers from the collection. Can you tell us a little bit about each exhibit?
So starting with Ragnar Kjerkensen's The Visitors, it's basically this multi-channel hour-long music video with these nine Icelandic musicians who are all just sort of friends of the organizing artist Ragnar Kjerkensen. And they rented out a house in upstate New York, the Rockby Farm Mansion in Hudson Valley. It's really cool when you're in there because you'll see the entire audience in this sort of collective, you know, procession going to these different screens looking to see what's going on. And the other one, the underexposed exhibition, was this beautiful, like stunning collection of female photographers. It was initially planned for last year for the centennial of the 19th Amendment, and it was delayed because of COVID. I'm very glad that the High Museum chose to still display the curation. It's sort of a historical overview of the history of, you know, women and photography.
How we consume art has obviously changed a lot in the past year and a half. What was it like going to a physical museum in these times?
You know, being able to go into the High when I came to Atlanta was exciting enough. And then, you know, especially with the visitors, where the audience sort of has that, you know, collective movement, that was powerful. Just being in the same space with other people, but then also, you know, having a sort of collective experience. And as far as the underexposed photography exhibition, you know, a lot of the women photographers focus on the home, you know, in large part due to, you know, women historically being sort of, you know, pushed into the domestic life. So even though the exhibition was delayed and it wasn't planned for COVID, it really did translate quite well because a lot of the images address issues of the home, domesticity, and that sort of feeling of being trapped.
What does being able to see art in person mean? Why is it so special?
That is like probably one of the bigger questions in art right now, even aside from COVID. You know, we live in a world that is just totally, totally taken over by images. I think a lot of the power of, you know, visiting museums is that collective experience where, you know, you're in a room full of people who are all looking at the same thing. And also taking the time to step out of ordinary life. You know, you're going to a location that is specifically for consuming art. So you're really sort of embodying that mindset.
Thank you for listening to this season of Wheel Talk and our first ever podcast here at The Wheel. We will be taking a hiatus, but we'll be back late summer and all throughout next school year. Also, look out for more audio projects coming from The Wheel. If you have ideas for what Wheel Talk should cover next, email us at emorywheelexec@gmail.com. I'll talk to you soon. Wheel Talk is produced by Gabriella Lewis, Kaylin Chin, Ninad Kulkarni, and Isaiah Poritz, with assistant producers Catherine Anaezwe, Carly Cullen, and Ethan Anthony, and help from Isabel Packard. Music courtesy of Pond 5 and cover art by Kaylin Chin.